Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Right now, I'd like to welcome Venerable Robina Korten. She has been on the show before. She is a Buddhist teacher, and there will be a benefit to benefit the work of the Liberation Prison Project, which she runs this coming Sunday. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Happy to be here again.
So you teach in the Tibetan Buddhist lineage.
Right, exactly.
And you're Australian.
Yes.
And just to brief our listeners who haven't heard you on the air before, how did you go from being a kind of a, how should we say, young wild woman to being a Buddhist
an old wild
practitioner?
Woman. Brought up a Catholic in Australia, and since a little girl, I think I was always sort of the kind of mind that wanted to sort of understand things, you know, and I loved God, I'd go to Mass every morning, and when I was 12, I was on my knees begging my mother to let me be a nun like St. Therese of Lisieux. I liked all these extremists, I'm a bit of an extremist, you see, and of course I cried when she said no, and then 20 years later, after I'd been through various things, my mother cried when I told her I was going to be a Buddhist nun, you know, so in that period, I think it was just this, call it search, I mean it sounds grand, but you know, using your mind, thinking about things, and I always wanted the big picture, so I was a Catholic, and then I gave that up and got into sort of sex and drugs and jazz and hippie and then radical lefty and then feminist, kind of, just then when I was about 30, 31 I think, mid-70s, met these Tibetan Lamas, became a nun soon after.
Now, if somebody is, for example, born in Tibet and at the age of 7, they say to their parents, I want to be a nun,
right.
Are their parents happy?
Oh, delighted. They send them off right there. Yes.
So that's something that is understood as a
yes,
calling.
Absolutely. I think it's easily a sixth of the population were monastic in Tibet.
And they were all called to it. I mean, I remember in the European medieval tradition,
yes,
the first son or the third daughter, whatever
that's right,
what it is.
That's right.
Even if it's not a calling for them.
Yes, that's right. I think Tibetans like that. Every family has a monk or a nun. Yes.
So you then became a Buddhist nun, and
yes,
now you're a teacher. And I want to talk about the Liberation Prison Project,
yes,
which is something that you're focused on among many projects in your life. What's that all about?
Well, I came to the States... Well, I was here in the 70s first, but I came here this time in 94, and I was editor of a Buddhist magazine, Mandala, which is a magazine of the organization I'm part of, FPMT, and Thupten Norbu Ling, who invite me here, they're my sister center, they're part of that organization. So I was the editor of the magazine, and we were based at the time in California, Santa Cruz, and I think in 96 we got a letter from a young Mexican ex-gangster, he told me, 18 years old, in this top security prison in California, where they're it's this type of situation that they call now security housing unit, which was actually considered against human rights when they first brought these in, but now it's really common in all the states and around the world, where people are in their cells 23 hours a day and have 1 hour in another cell with very limited, you know, objects. Like these guys are allowed to have 10 books, the inside of a pen only, because you might stab your cellmate with a hard part, a pad, and maybe that's about it, you know, and they spend 23 hours a day in there. Well, this guy, Arturo, he'd read a Buddhist book and was very moved by the talk of compassion and wrote a letter, and it landed on my desk. He wrote to the magazine. So it started from there. I wrote him. He was very sincere. I sent him a book. I visited him, and within a year, I had 40 people writing. And I just
now, this was a guy who had multiple life sentences.
Yes.
He was never getting out of there.
Never getting out of there.
And so yet... in the midst of that misery and in these cell blocks that defy human rights,
that's right,
he wanted happiness. What happened? Tell us his story.
Yeah, well, I think what I'm seeing over these years now is 14, well, that's 96, that's 13 years we've been going. And how it works, since that time, we get letters from prisoners. And I've found over the years that this is the most precious way we can help people, because there's an enormous amount of movement in prisons. People get moved from prison to prison. We have people go in, but within, you know, in a month they'll be in another prison. So we have a team of a couple of hundred now, volunteer teachers around the world, and we have this whole system. People write, and then we assign them when they really want something more to a person to take care of them. And so I can see from these letters, you know, we've got these amazing letters, so moving. But from the beginning, from Arturo, because he's intelligent, young guy, these Mexicans are super intelligent, you know, but they live up in this, they live in an environment in Los Angeles where all they see is gangs. It's their universe, you know. So since the time he's 11, gangs completely his life. then 12 in prison, juvenile prison, until he's 16, and then three life sentences for not killing anybody, but just for gang activity, because the gang activity is so intense. So there he is in a regular part of the prison, but he's part of the gangs. I mean, there are prison gangs, you know, so it's their whole world, it's their universe, it runs the system, it's so intense. So, of course...
Within the prison.
Oh, my God, not even, but more so. Actually, there are prisons, there are gangs that are unique to the prisons. There's this whole culture that's developed over 50 years, I think. Mexican gangs, black gangs, fascist gangs, you know, Asian gangs. And it's just astonishing, the level of activity of it. So, I think in the 70s, they or maybe late 80s, they began to build these security housing units to take the troublemakers off the main yards, because they're having their wars all the time. They're stabbing each other and constantly killing each other, you know. That's what they do.
With the insides of pens?
Insides of pens, or I asked one of my guys how they make knives. He said, oh, you use anything, Rabina, even plastic bottles. But he said, they're not much good. You can only use them once. So they're very creative, you know. So these prisons where they're stuck in their cells 23 hours a day, you either go crazy, and that's really common. You're in a cell with another person, 8 foot by 10 foot, the door's closed 23 hours a day, 1 hour up and down in your shackles in another cell. So it's
that would drive you crazy if it was the person you loved most
precisely,
in the world.
That's the whole point, Mary Charlotte, I swear to you. So these guys who've got these very strong minds, and many have, and they're intelligent, they've got to look outside. So many of them educate themselves, they're learning languages, they're doing courses, and they have some decent libraries. And so one of them found a book by Lama Yeshe, and this one, Arturo, and he was moved by this talk of compassion, his heart opened. So that's now 96, you know, so he's been communicating ever since, and he's developed a really strong practice, and that's what we're seeing, so many of them. And they transform themselves, you know.
So what happens to their role in the gang and the prison culture when they transform themselves?
It's not easy, because you've got, you know, you've got your mafia, you've got the heads of the gangs, and they're like your Dalai Lama, as one of them said to me. So he and another cellmate of his, Francisco, both of whom became Buddhists, who, you know, I've known since 96, they had to write a letter to their boss, to their guy on their unit, you know, saying that they were deciding to leave the gangs, but they would never snitch, because the worst crime is to snitch. So, you know, then you just have to protect yourself. That's all.
We're talking to Venerable Rabina Korten. So, do you feel that they have to be at a certain stage in their karmic spiritual development to even be open to this in the first place?
I understand, yeah. Well, you know, as you know, I'm sure, Mary Charlotte, one of the really big focuses in Buddhist practice is this knowledge of your own mind. You know, Buddha's an amazing psychologist. He didn't use that word then, you know, but that's exactly what he is. Spiritual practice in Buddhism is becoming a very skillful human being who knows yourself well. You use meditation to learn about yourself, you know. And so you have to have that wish. And that's what I'm seeing that's quite astonishing and is counter to what we tend to think of. You've got to have a certain kind of intelligence, an emotional intelligence that wants to do that. It doesn't just dump, you know. So what we see over the years, 99%, I'd say, of the 15,000, 20,000 people who've written to us just in the States, they're working class, uneducated, been in violent situations around gangs, around drugs. They're not what you think of as an intelligent person. Many can't even read. But we've found, because they've got this natural intelligence that's never been developed, you start giving them books, they start looking inside themselves. They're astonishing. They've got this intelligence there, and we help them grow it, you know. But you've got to have that aspect. You've got to have this wish to look inside, the wish to give up blame, the wish to know that you've got potential. That's the quality you need to be a successful Buddhist, really, because that's what it's about.
So you've taught many non-prisoners, and you've taught many prisoners.
Yep.
How would you characterize the difference in these two groups as students?
I think there's one way, there's absolutely no difference. I don't say anything different to anybody, because we're all human beings. It doesn't matter what house we live in, whether it's a disgusting house with bars on it or a fancy house, you know. But the difference is, I think, because they're more in touch with their suffering. Especially we who have a relatively reasonable life, you know, we mightn't be very rich or very famous, but we've got a reasonable life with reasonable friends, money in the bank. We just kind of float along, I think. We sort of think, well, I'm okay. I'm not really suffering. I mean, so Buddha talks about, in the Four Noble Truths, he talks about different levels of suffering. And one, the first one is like called the suffering of suffering, in-your-face suffering, which is prison, cancer, sickness, homelessness, when things go wrong, you know. The second kind is more subtle. It's like a honey-covered razor blade, which is the one we live in. And that's the suffering. They call it the suffering of change. What it really refers to, as Lama Zopa said, when he turned 21, this young guy, I asked Lama Zopa to send him a 21st birthday card. And I'm paraphrasing, but he essentially said to him, your prison is nothing in comparison with the inner prison of ordinary people. The prison of attachment, the prison of depression, the prison of pride, the prison of anger. And I think that's the thing that these guys in prison, they've got the gross one, but they know they can't change that, but they know they can change this one. So they're in touch with this, and they really understand that. They really do understand that it's the mental suffering, the ordinary daily mental suffering we all have. That's the one. And when you change that, that's what liberation means.
And they really are able to change it, even within those horrifying conditions.
I'm not saying they're all perfect. I mean, how can they be? This, of course not. But what I'm seeing is, and what is so moving, is the unbelievable effort. The ones we know, we've known many of them for 14 years. They've been around us, you know, all these years, 13 years. And they really struggle. I mean, we publish a newsletter every 2 months, and we quote a lot from their letters, and we're going to do a book of their letters and the letters of their teachers. I mean, it's just incredibly moving, because the effort they make, the effort to develop their confidence, and that's the way we help people, you know, using Buddha's tools, but what you're doing is just being a good friend, telling them you can do it, you have potential, you're not just some creep, which is what you've believed all your life. It's that part that's very, very moving and very inspiring. For me, it's what makes me, at all costs, try to keep it going, you know.
I notice, just from day to day, the extent to which my own happiness is based on the fact that I have nice food.
That's exactly
and
right.
Warm blankets and things like that.
That's it,
but the
Charlotte.
Thing is, you don't know, I don't yes. know, really yes. how I would respond
that's
if those
right.
things were taken away. And most
that's
of us don't.
No,
and we don't want to know.
No, that's right. That's the key. And I think that's, if we're looking at really getting like an essential level of practice, the key to success is when you don't get what you want, that you're able to handle it. That shows you're making progress. Because it's easy to be happy. You know, the junkie in us loves to get all our nice things, and it's very easy for us. But the second we don't, that's the moment practice begins. And that's the level that these guys exist at. So their practice is a sort of a more advanced level, because they're already dealing with garbage, you know?
Now, in any given prison yeah. where you're working with people, do you teach courses in meditation to groups, or is it really just more corresponding with the individuals?
The biggest program we have, which I find is really successful, is one-on-one contact. Because you develop a relationship with one person, and it really can become very personal. We also have people who go in. I mean, Don Brown, the resident teacher at Thuc Thanh Norby Luong here in Santa Fe, he goes into a prison. We're going on Monday. So many of our people do go into prison as well as correspond. But the thing is that there may be one or two, but the group changes. But it's both. I mean, we do both. You know, we have correspondence courses. We send lots and lots of books. We have a vast collection of books. And one of our main things is to give books away. We're sending 50 packages every day, and we try to be very generous, because that's the basis of their stuff, you know, reading. And they're hungry. I mean, they're hungry, you know.
And so that's, of course, why you have to do these benefits and fundraisers and so on. I mean, you may have volunteer labor, but it uh-huh. costs money to get all these books and send
yeah.
them and so on.
Well, also, because we made decision years ago to go in this direction, we get these letters. We get 1,000 letters a month now. We've had a staff until recently, and I've had to cut down because money's so desperate. We've been spending up to $40,000 a month running the prison project, and that's not including all the volunteer labor. That's
wow.
the staff and the office and the infrastructure and buying the books and the phone systems and all the things that it costs to have a decent database and keep track of everything. Because you've got to track every single person exactly what books they can have. Can they have this paper? Can they have staples?
Right.
Can they? The
oh,
bureaucracy
heavens.
In prisons is astonishing, you know. So we've now cut our staff down to two, and I'm struggling. I mean, I think I almost haven't got enough to run until the end of January, and I just desperately want at all costs just to keep it going, because the work we've been doing these last 12 years is really quite remarkable, you know.
There will be a benefit at the Thuc Thanh Norby Luong Buddhist Center at 149 East Alameda Street here in downtown Santa Fe on Sunday at 7 o'clock, Sunday, February 1st at 7 in the evening. Have you noticed that there's any positive effect when the prisoners meditate on their guards and wardens? I mean, do you
yeah,
see
I
that
understand.
Kind of ripple effect?
I think the ripple effect we mainly hear about is among the prisoners. So I can think of, there's one guy I've known, I've been visiting him for years in Kentucky on death row, Mitch. He's been practicing Buddhism, I don't know now, since the early 90s. He's getting closer to his death, you know, because, you know, when you start the process of appeals, it takes 20, 25 years. So he's getting closer to when they finally will, you know, be executed. So he lives in a unit of about 40 people, I think, all the guys on death row in Kentucky. So I can see over the years, from being there myself, I visit quite a lot and I've known many of them. The effect is just extraordinary. He's this good man, putting together his life, being kind, just taking care of the people around him. And the effect is enormous. It has to be in a slow, gradual kind of way. You know? It has to be. And among the guards, I'm not so sure about that. I mean, we've had a couple of experiences. Mainly, I think, in Australia more. I think in Australia, I find the system there is very different. I think 30 years ago, they gave up the military model of running the prisons. They talk about managers there. So something's quite different in the way they run the
right.
prisons, and I think they're more civilized in many ways. So I think we have more interest among all the staff in Australia than we do in the United States.
It would be interesting. I mean, you can't do this, but it would be nice if you could do a study to see what incarnation these prisoners took the next time around.
It would be interesting, exactly. It would be.
We're talking to Venerable Rubina Curtin. So what about the relationship between... I mean, in prisons, there's a lot of Christian ministers
yes,
who are trying
that's
to...
Right.
To do their work
yes,
there.
Exactly.
Are they supportive? Do you get animosity?
I understand. A whole spectrum of responses. In the beginning, there weren't so many Buddhist groups going into prisons. There weren't many Buddhist monks or nuns. And so in the beginning, with many of them, I have to say I found, and still it's the same with respect, a lot very, quite fundamentalist. So I was sort of like the devil, you know. I mean, in Texas, for example, I was visiting some prisons and I'd forgotten one of them. And the guy there, if he'd known I'd come to Texas and not visited, he would have been brokenhearted. So I called the chaplain at the last minute, because you're supposed to organize well in advance and get approval and things. And he was as cold as ice, you know. He said, we don't need people like you here. Just completely not interested. We had another experience in Texas. The warden of the prison where there's a guy on death row who wanted me to be there with him when they executed him. And he just flatly refused. He said, you're not religious. You don't believe in a creator. Even though Texas law accepts Buddhist churches, you know.
Right.
So to try and you can't, and because of the bureaucracy in prisons, with respect, I'm not even complaining really, there's no benefit in trying to get your rights. And this takes years, you know. So I find that just to have always enormous respect for people, always thank all the chaplains, be incredibly, we've got a good relationship with a lot of chaplains actually, and I think it's so important that we cultivate that relationship, because eventually those who've got open minds can see that we're doing a good job and are very appreciative and really support us. But it's taken a while.
Have you done that with other people, been with them during their executions?
Not yet, no. No. This guy's execution got stayed anyway, so it was okay. But not yet, no.
It does bring up the question, what has this work done for you and for your own practice?
I think the one of enthusiasm and really understanding human suffering at a deeper level without making it sound grand, you know. And realizing that no matter, and I think this one, that no matter how bad things get, we find these resources inside us. I think that's what astonishes me about people in prison. When I can't conceive of these situations, you know. And there's no, I mean, there's no kind of, I'm not trying to think of them as victims, that their own actions got them there. But it's just, it would be just a nightmare, you know. They're like hellholes, some of them. The violence, the disgusting food. I mean, there's so many things about them. You have no freedom to breathe even, you know, in some of these places. So I can't conceive of that. I'd go mad. I'd kill people, you know. When you're so used to having the freedom to do what you want, like walk out a door and have simple things. I think almost, you can almost say that being homeless is more free. I'm not trying to compare suffering.
Right.
Because it's just this stultifying kind of awful experience. So to try and grow within that. So for me, it's so humbling, so humbling. When I begin to think of even a moment of my own suffering, I just think of this and it calms me, you know.
What about when people get out? I mean, many of the practitioners
yes.
in prison aren't on death row.
That's right.
Do you see them continuing to practice
yeah.
when they
a
get
whole,
out?
A whole mixture. Some go back into prison. This, you know, a really dear man we've known for years in Michigan. This is part of the trouble of the system. You know, it's once you're in the system, it's very hard to escape it. So a dear man with wife and kids got out of prison. He used to do pottery when he was in prison. He'd send us lovely things. And he finally got out. His sentence was finished. But then he happened to be in a house where other paroled prisons were, where one of them had drugs. So because of that, they all got put back in again.
Oh, no.
This kind of thing.
Right. Very,
all the trouble is, you know, one young California guy whom we used to communicate with, many have no money, no resources. He doesn't have his social security number. They don't bother to give him one while he's in prison. They get him out on a long weekend. There's no money, no social security, so you're frozen. So, you know, he gets right back in again. So it's not very intelligent the way it's all run, you know. But many of them are now writing to other prisoners, doing well with their lives. It's a whole mixture.
So tell us a little bit about the other work that you're doing besides the prison project.
Well, I've been doing that for 14 years and 12 years, whatever I keep forgetting, 13 years. Apart from that, I teach around the world. The last 25 years, going around the various Buddhist centers that are part of the organization I'm part of. Teaching, that's what I'm doing now. I'm away for about 6 weeks. I'm from here, go to Japan, then Australia, to a bunch of cities.
And so what do you teach? Elementary meditation basics?
No, I mean, Buddhist philosophy in a very kind of unpacked way, down to earth, realistic, practical, talking about all the things, the whole big picture, talking about Buddha's views of the universe, you know, and trying to see how we can use that to apply to our own lives. For me, the really important thing is to demystify, because I think we so easily mystify anything that's called spiritual. We lose our common sense a bit.
What are some of the incorrect notions that people have that they bring to you about Buddhist practice or Buddhism?
Well, I think there's kind of a cliched idea that, you know, being a Buddhist means being mindful. And nothing wrong with that. But as one lama said, well, you know, that's fine. Thieves need mindfulness too. You know, so we can kind of make it make it like a virtue in itself. But it's just clearly it's a very necessary quality to do anything well. So obviously we want to use it to know our minds well and change ourselves. So we can romanticize things, I think. But I think really, certainly the Tibetan Buddhist approach, you know, the approach that appeals to me, it really is, it's sort of really being a Buddhist is like a cognitive therapist. You learn to go beneath the emotions to sort of unravel the thinking behind the emotions, you know. So you start to hear the thoughts behind the emotions, and that's when you realize you can start to change, because you can change thoughts. We think we can't change emotions. We think we're kind of stuck with them. You know, we're born this way, what can I do? But when you go beneath the anger and start to see the concepts that are behind anger, this view that that person is ugly, that person is the cause of all my suffering, it's a viewpoint, you know. You can change viewpoints, and I think that's the real skill that Buddha has. And I think to begin to see Buddhism in this way is quite liberating.
I was having an interesting conversation with somebody the other day who was asking me about Buddhism. They said, well, if it's all about, if the idea that nobody else causes your suffering mm-hmm. is true, then is there anything but total subjectivity?
Sure.
Is there any right and wrong? Is there any reality?
Yep, exactly. I think the thing is, because our materialist view is so much that I am the victim of circumstances. I was made by someone else. People make me angry. People make me happy. We sort of know our mind plays a role, but I think we put an enormous emphasis on the outside only. So that's why we have the victim, that's kind of the victim mode, you know. So sometimes when you start to practice Buddhism, you've got to overemphasize the opposite view, which is Buddha's saying, you know, sure, you punch me in the nose. Punching in the nose. Check your checklist of immoralities. That's an immorality. It's wrong to punch in the nose. Meanwhile, what can I do about it myself? I can change my mind. And this is why these prisoners are a great example. Many of these guys might be there unjustly, for example. But what's the benefit of going crazy? I mean, a good example here. I remember I read this about this amazing woman who was, in fact, wrongly accused of murder, and she eventually was released. I think she's written a book. I can't think of her name now. But she, and then another, I read about them both at the same time, another guy who was also wrongly accused. And this is really the point for me. He would, every day, going out of his brain, raging, screaming, I did not rape and kill that woman. Out of his brain. He was right. He didn't. But look what happened to him. He went mad. The other woman accepted this reality because she couldn't change it. So what could she change? Her own mind. And that's the point. Of course there's objective reality. Of course there's immorality. But meanwhile, what can you do about your mind to help deal with it? And it's just super intelligent. It's just skillful. And we can see in our lives anybody, Buddhist or not, who can change themselves in this way. They're the ones who are happy and skillful in lives, you know.
I think it also, what you're saying illustrates the point that even if you don't understand the whole giant philosophy, if you practice anyway, then you might take steps toward understanding that philosophy through practicing.
Absolutely. And as I often say in the teachings, you know, if 1% of what you've just heard is useful to you, take that. If you want the 100%, that's cool. That's up to you. You're the boss, not Buddha. Take what works. And that emphasizes, don't just come to the teaching and think of it as entertainment, which is how we tend to think of spiritual. I mean, if it were a cooking class, you'd have your pen and paper because you'd want the instruction. You'd forget it. Well, whatever you're hearing in a Buddhist class is an instruction that you could, if you wish, use it in your life. It's a practical thing, and that's the one to try and emphasize. And it's 1%, fantastic.
One thing that we had some of the Buddhist monks who were visiting Santa Fe on the air the other day, and I think around before Christmas or before New Year's, and what was interesting to me, we asked them about what their day was like in the monastery back in India.
Yeah.
And a good chunk of it is actually devoted to debate.
Yeah, that's
so they
right.
sit there and debate. And I would think not just about the texts, but about how those texts apply.
Absolutely. That's the technique that's really developed, that's come from actually an amazing tradition of monasteries, monastic universities in India. The big Mahayana monasteries, 7th, 8th, up to the 11th century. This incredible tradition of sort of using intelligence to rip apart the tenets, not just to blindly believe, because as you know, Buddha's not a creator, so there's no concept in Buddhism of blindly believing something. It's to learn to see the truth of it. And if there's not truth in it, as the Dalai Lama says, if you can find by pulling something apart, there's no truth in it, well, you must reject Buddha. Excuse me, it's got to be realistic, it's got to be real. And we live at this intellectual level, you know. We live at an intellectual level, a cognitive level. So that's one very powerful approach into the Buddhist teaching, is to sort of use your intelligence to see, to try and find, unpack the truth of it.
So you will be doing an event this Sunday, the 1st of February at 7 o'clock at the Tupten Norbuling Buddhist Center at 149 East Alameda Street. What will you be doing that evening?
Well, that's like a party, you know, but we're having teachings all weekend. Friday night. Teaching at Friday night.
Let's see. Yeah, I've got a piece of paper here. Right.
Yeah, and then all weekend.
Oh, okay.
And I think the topic is happiness. We're going to be looking at the whole business of happiness, what it is and how to achieve it and what it actually means. Friday night, Saturday and Sunday.
And so if people are interested in that, they can, it's at Body?
Yep, at Body.
So they can go to bodyofsantafe.com, they can call Body, and also they can register at tnlsf.org. Is that your organization?
Tupten Norbuling Center, yeah, exactly.
So, Venerable Robina Curtin, thank you so much for being with us.
Okay.
And it's been nice to have you every few years here on the air, and we hope you come back.
Thank you.